Hey everybody, welcome back to The Hustle. It's John Lamoureux. All right, this week's guest is Anthony Kaczynski. Anthony was the lead singer of a band in the 80s out of Detroit called Figures on a Beach. They started out in the early part of the decade as more of a very adventurous, sort of avant-garde electronic band along the lines of early Simple Minds, Can, Noi. We talk about that in here. Those kind of influences. By the time they put out their two major label albums in the late 80s, they were more of a straightforward dance, synth pop, slash rock group. They never had a ton of success, unfortunately. They probably deserved it. They did produce one of my all-time favorite songs that you're listening to right now. Maybe you remember it. It's called Accidentally 4th Street, also known as Gloria. I want to make sure I mention that because you'll hear it referred to as under both names in this interview. I have always loved this song. It came out in 1989. The band broke up in the early 90s. That was pretty much it. So I had been wanting to find Anthony for a long time. And when I did, he introduced me to the band that he's in now, which is called Fire King. I don't normally say this. I talk to a lot of people who are still putting out new music, and that's great, and I'm really happy for them. But Fire King is an amazing power pop band, and they've put out two albums, the most recent of which came out last year. It's called Double Trouble. It is one of the most amazing power pop albums I have ever heard. If you are a fan of Cheap Trick, and these days, who isn't, you owe it to yourself to check out Fire King's Double Trouble album. So this is one of the rare times I am actually more excited about the music these people, as Anthony specifically, is putting out today than I even am about the stuff that turned me on to him in the first place. He's a really super guy. You'll notice from this conversation that his heart is very much still in Detroit. Name checks a lot of people, a lot of places he played. You can tell he would love to be back there. You can also tell that this guy's got a ton of spirit. It's no question and no wonder why he is as busy as a musician as he is today. Now, granted, these are all mostly smaller projects, but they are keeping him extremely vibrant and extremely alive, and you can tell that in this interview. I also think it's really, really interesting if you listen how he's been able to pay his bills all of this time. He owns a very interesting company. We'll talk about it later in the interview, but through owning that company, it's been able to sort of pay his bills as he's gone out and done a lot of smaller scale musical projects that he loves that feeds that part of his passion. It's a really interesting story. The guy has a lot of spirit. I liked him a lot. He actually lives in Boston, and that's where he called me from.
Where do you want to begin?
Well, I always kick these things off, actually, with a little story about how I discovered whoever it is that I'm talking to, since often I'm talking to people who are not really in the public eye as much anymore. And I grew up in Salt Lake City. I don't know if you know this, but Salt Lake City loves 80s alternative music, especially synth pop. In fact, they still do. Like, Howard Jones sells out large venues in Utah still to this day. They just love it. Mm-hmm. So, Accidentally 4th Street would be one of those songs that I would hear on the radio periodically, but never know who sang it or the name of the song. I just knew I loved it, and it didn't, I don't think I ever even caught the whole song. I'd catch it like at the end or something. And because it doesn't say Accidentally 4th Street in the song, if the DJ announced, you know, what had just been playing, I would never connect the two. So I knew there was this song that I liked, but I had no idea how to find it, who sang it, anything like that. Until the mid-90s, and I'm in college, and a guy down the hall has the Just Say Mao compilation.
Right.
And I'm, you know, in the throes of making mixtapes, as you do. And he had a lot of that great stuff, that indie stuff that from the 80s that I didn't have my hands on. So I'm making mixtapes. That's where I finally connected the dots between who you were and that song and the name. It remains one of my favorite songs ever. In all honesty, I don't know much else about the band other than that song. And there's not a ton out there to, like, research. So I have no concept if you guys were big, if you guys played big shows. I don't know how many albums you sold. origin stories are not always that interesting, but what was it like at its peak being a member of Figures on a Beach?
Actually, you know, there was a point. There was a point somewhere, I'm not sure I could pinpoint the exact year, but somewhere between 1983 and 89 where we really felt like we were going to become something fairly large. I mean, we played a lot of large venues. And it's
really
funny that you mentioned Salt Lake City because, and I'll get into it in more depth later, we did a club tour on our own as a headliner in 89 on that album, which is the second album on Desire that we did called Figures on a Beach.
Yep.
And we played, and we were routed through Salt Lake City on a Monday night after playing Columbia, Missouri at the Blue Note on a Saturday. And in order to really get there, we sort of had to leave Columbia and drive all the way through and then, you know, sleep during the day. And then we had an in-store on Monday in Bountiful, which I always remember going to Bountiful.
That's where my wife is from. Yeah.
Wow,
did anyone show up?
That was.
Oh,
they
did. Oh, good. Okay. Mondays are family nights in the Mormon culture, so I'm surprised. I didn't know that's where you were going.
No, this was an in-store during the day at a record store.
Oh, good. Okay. Great.
And then we had a gig at this place called the Bar and Grill or something like that in Salt Lake City. Monday nights are Monday nights. I mean, sometimes you play to very sparse crowds, especially when you're on the road and you're a headliner thing. And we got there, and that place was packed to the rafters. It stunned all of us.
Good.
A crowd that knew all the songs. So for whatever reason, we touched a nerve in Salt Lake City in 1989. That's my only time through there, ever.
Oh, really? That was the one time you played? Huh.
Yeah, it was a pretty positive experience, seriously. Like, I remember that gig as being like, whoa.
Who knew, right?
Right.
Yeah, like I was saying, they embraced and still embrace. I mean, there's generations that still, I'm sure that if you were to go play there, you'd have probably a better showing than you might in other places, just because they are very nostalgic for that 80s alternative scene. It's crazy.
Right.
So, well, cool. Man, I'm glad you had a good experience. That doesn't always happen in Utah, so I'm glad. Now, the story on you guys, the party line, is that you're from Detroit, and you're in this band, and you moved to Boston to make it, right?
The world is always a little more complex than what you
of course
wind up seeing in a press release.
Yeah.
So basically, Figures on a Beach formed out of the remnants of a band that I seriously wish would have been recorded, because honestly, I think we were way ahead of the game. And that contained Rick Ralski, who was also the guitar player in Figures. He and I are sort of the founding members of Figures on a Beach, the two people who put the thing together. We were in a band called Razor 1922 from the tail end of 1979 to the end of 1980.
The sense of the room, put together in the middle of the floor. The full sense of the room, put together by the door, there's just a door. The full sense of the room, in the middle of the room. There is a door in the middle of the room.
We had another sort of non-musician Eno type named Paul Schwacko who sang as well, and a really great drummer named Mick Flores, and I played a Farfisa Compact Deluxe and a string synth and played the bass on the left-hand keyboards. There weren't a lot of bands using keyboards in anywhere near as interesting a way as we were in Detroit at that time. And I'd actually venture to say anywhere when I listened back
really
to the stuff we did. It was really very experimental and did have a certain, you know, there were songs. It wasn't atonal, but we would veer off. I mean, we did one gig where we actually improvised the whole gig.
Interesting.
We made a decision at the beginning of the, like, 5 minutes before we went on
to
an improv, because we had that sort of ability. And we were big fans of Can.
That's what I was going to ask you. Is this like the Can, Kraftwerk, Noise
very
type
much.
Stuff?
Okay. Very much. Great. And if you really follow the roots of Detroit techno, you know, we get written out of that story, but that's the unholy fusion. You know, it's like techno is like dance music and Kraftwerk meeting in Detroit, basically.
That's amazing.
At any rate, at the end of 1980, and we were starting to build an audience, and this followed a line of perverse thinking that would probably follow us our whole career. The decision was made to scrap the identity of Razor 1922, and we changed the name of the band to Figures on a Beach, and we kept the same personnel as Razor and added a high school friend of mine named Steve Schroed on yet another third keyboard. So, and this we did maybe 8 gigs like this, 5 gigs, 6, some very small amount of gigs. Worked up new material. It was very dark, and there was a schism in the band, and half of them decided after a gig in Lansing that they wanted to go in a different direction, and Rick Rolfsky and I were standing out in a parking lot in East Lansing, Michigan, going, now what do we do? And I said, look, let's get two other people and continue Figures on a Beach. So that's what we did, and we knew Michael Smith, who's the drummer, and who's also the drummer in Fire King, the band I'm in now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we knew him well, and he was in a band called L7, which is not the L7 that...
Not the girls.
You know, this is
the
earlier.
Right,
and this had Larissa Starlchuk, who wound up in the Laughing Hyenas later on. And a really great guitar player named Dave Rice. Michael was unhappy in the band, and we floated him an offer to join, and he jumped at it. And Chris Ewan, who was our keyboard player for the balance of it, was an enormous Razor fan. So that one was really easy. He wasn't in a band, and he was a good keyboard player. We knew it.
Okay.
Very creative. So that came together really quickly. And we wound up, you know, the breakup of the original Figures happened in, I want to say, early May. We were up and running with a completely retooled band by the end of June.
Now, can I interrupt you for 1 second? I saw a video clip just today of some old, looked like cable access channel from 1982, you guys performing something called The Body Homeless.
This Body Homeless.
We need to rule the code and a permanent consensus. We grew the patterns and live with that and it's a way to kill. Some will bring some bit for us, but it's belay of diminishing returns. Always right up in your little ears. Nothing to do, the place to go for. This body homeless, this heart so hardened. This body homeless, this heart so
also in East Lansing, Michigan. And I think that tape is flipped because everybody's playing with their wrong hands. Like, it looks like Rick Rolfsky is a lefty.
Right, okay.
It's flipped, and it's also on sync.
Yeah, I noticed that too, yeah.
That's the version of Figures, that's the original version of, not the original, but that's the one that I would consider the classic lineup.
Okay.
Of Figures with Michael Smith and with Chris Ewan. And that was done the morning after a gig in East Lansing, Michigan, and all of us were hurting terribly. I know that. I remember I remember how I felt. It's like, ooh, maybe a little early to be doing this.
the show goes on, though, right?
Of course it does. We did 4 or 5 songs. And I don't have the faintest idea of what happened to the others. And honestly, when I saw that online, you could have knocked me over. It's one of those things that I'd kind of forgotten about.
I can imagine. That was fun to see, though. That kind of technology, that kind of innocence and naivete, that this doesn't even exist anymore.
It certainly doesn't. So I've got my Farfisa there. Those are the Razor-era keyboards that I'm playing, and Chris and Michael. And you'll notice that Michael Smith has no cymbals on his drum. We were very into, like, no cymbals. You know,
crazy.
Queen was no synthesizers. We had tons of synthesizers, but no cymbals.
Was that kind of the mission? Were you guys sort of exploring, like, what you could do with electronic music, kind of like early OMD was doing, you know, around that kind of same time? Okay.
Absolutely. I think this band jumped the shark later. We were, but at this time, I still think they were great. The early period of Simple Minds was something we loved.
I love Simple Minds. They're one of my very favorite bands of all time.
And I'm really thinking like Empires and Dance.
Yeah.
Real to Real Cacophony. The Super Feelings Call.
The best albums ever. Yep.
That was the stuff that was really driving us right then.
Okay.
Loved
that,
that
makes sense.
You know, and it's funny because we put out an EP and later on Ira Robbins and Trouser Press, who was favorable towards it, said, think of them as an American Simple Minds.
I just read that. Yeah.
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 Which
I read
I thought,
that.
Well, he heard it because we,
yeah,
that's what we were listening to. It was
good.
It was a big thing for us.
Yeah, that's high praise. So how did the sound then shift from this experimental, you know, you could ask Simple Minds the same thing. How did the sound shift from this really experimental, deep synthesizer groove to, you know, poppier, synth pop, that kind of thing?
That's, you know, things evolve over the course of time. But we came out of the box in Detroit, and the first show we did with the new lineup, that sort of shocked me. We did it at this club called Nunzio's, and the great, almost forgotten club in Lincoln Park, but anybody who was there back in the day would remember it with great fondness.
Cool.
And Michael Smith, and as was our want, we would try to make every show an event back then. So coated the walls with silver for the entire club, and we had something like 350 black balloons in the place.
Oh, cool.
And I was terribly nervous before this because this is us really going out on our own. It's a big Friday night. And I got to the club and there was a line around the block. So we jumped out of the gate really fast. And we opened with our version of Good Times by Chic, which we sort of tried to turn it into a Joy Division take on.
Oh, really?
Like, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I give us a lot of credit in the early days for pushing the envelope, even if the execution was maybe not quite there yet. You know, we had good ideas. So,
well, Nile Rodgers himself was heavily influenced by Roxy Music, so what you're doing is not that far removed from something he probably would have done.
No,
that kind of thing is what inspired him to make Good Times in the first place.
Exactly.
So it makes sense.
I saw Roxy in 74, very early 75, I should say, in Detroit. And that's life-changing stuff. That was one of the best things ever.
Yeah,
I loved that band passionately. So anyways, songwriting is fun. I mean, we would evolve and we got popular. That's part of it. But we would do shows in art galleries. We took over a place that became famous in Detroit later on called the Gold Dollar Show Bar. That's a place where the White Stripes wound up playing in the 90s. Like, this is another piece of the history that gets left out. Sterling, who's kind of a legendary figure, sort of, I like to call him the Malcolm McLaren of Detroit, except he's a nice person.
<That's better.
laughs> but, you know, kind of an impresario, entrepreneur, promoter, ideas person. He's still very active there. He managed us, and he and I found this place, which was a drag bar in the Cass Corridor, and very, very, I would, you know, very singular environment, I'll put it that way. And
I believe
and
it.
Probably a David Lynch environment before there was something that would be codified as a David Lynch environment.
We
loved it. We absolutely loved it.
Good.
And we talked to the people, and we said, could we play here? They did not have a great deal of business, and they said, sure. So we put together a show, and we had a woman named Misty Knight who performed to Trans-Europe Express with, like, you know, flaming swords and all this stuff.
Nice.
It was pretty intense.
Interesting how experimental you guys were and avant-garde. I mean, those are your roots, right?
Those are our roots. Yeah,
crazy. I wouldn't have guessed.
We got noticed, and we also, like, even though, you know, this is the arrogance of being 21, 22, I was like, I don't want to just confine ourselves to Detroit. So we immediately got in the car and we would go and drive to Chicago and Toronto and arrange gigs. And we wound up making friends with people who I'm friends with today. Terry Fox, who ran The Exit, he took us in and he gave us gigs. And we wound up playing shows with the early version of Ministry. a great deal back and forth in Chicago. They'd play in Detroit. We'd play there with them. Al Jorgensen tried to poach me and Chris Ewan.
Really?
in early 82, which is another.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Could have been a member of Ministry.
And I thought, he's just trying to eat up the competition.
Right.
So I slightly declined.
Oh, that's great.
But that's
wow.
a true story. That's a true story.
Okay.
I got a call at my job, and it was from Al Jorgensen in like May of 1982 or whatever.
Now, let me ask you something. So one of the things we cover on here as delicately and sensitively as we can is the money side of all of this. So are you working a day job, like a regular job, like normal people, and then performing at night? Or are
Absolutely.
You getting so big in Detroit that you can make a living as a musician? No.
Look,
okay.
No. It never really happened at all at any point
okay.
in time.
No I wondered about that.
When it was. I had weird jobs. I was at a very young age, I was a manager of a finance company, General Finance. If you look inside the Fire King album, my business card is on the gatefold. So I did that, and Michael Smith's parents owned an office supply company that's no longer in business in Detroit called Gregory, Mayer, and Tom, and we rehearsed in the building. We used
okay.
the van, and then three out of the four guys wound up working there.
Oh, okay.
Sort of like
yeah.
they hold their job, you know?
Yeah,
it was fine.
Sure.
And Chris Ewan was worked at the largest record store chain in Detroit at the time, Harmony House, and so he was
okay.
a real presence there. So.
So there was never a point where you could go in and, like, screw this place and quit your job and run off and be a rock star. Or maybe that
no,
comes
I
later.
No, I did say screw this job and quit a job, but then I
right.
it was just
then you had to go get another job.
Yeah, which was sort of
okay.
a funny one that someday I'll write the short story about. I was the collection manager for a dating service.
Oh, yes. That sounds
yeah, we'll
great.
Leave that one just hanging
okay.
there. And you can,
okay.
You can, on the list of odd jobs I have held, that is the oddest one of all.
That sounds like it. Oh, man, that's great.
But that's when things started heating up for Figures. So the thing that would happen in Detroit is we were kind of in our own little field there.
Okay.
Most of the bands in Detroit did not sound anything like us. So when a band, like, for example, when the Psychedelic Furs came through town on their very first tour and played
wow.
Bookies, which was the great punk club there, Razor 1922 got tapped to open for them. I just think that that's something
yes.
that would be compatible. So very early on, I think our sixth gig, we opened for OMD at
oh,
Bookies
right
again.
On.
Echo and the Bunnymen, first tour.
Yep. Okay, so you were that band.
We were that band, and we...
Yeah, you were aligned with those guys. That makes sense.
That's a very fast track to getting a fan base,
yep.
especially if you can hold your own, with
yeah.
it, which we always...
Definitely.
Well, I remember we opened for Teardrop Explodes, and I thought, geez,
ooh.
I loved Julian Cope. We were better
yeah.
than them that night. And that show, in fact, caught the attention of Vince Bannon, who had run Bookies previously and then was running Clutch Cargos, which was a much bigger club, and we were playing that place pretty regularly and doing real well with it. And then they moved
good.
It out of there and brought it into St. Andrews Hall, which is still a venue in Detroit. And we were actually
yeah.
the first band to play there.
I was seeing on Facebook when I was looking at that, some of your video. Well, there's not that many videos, unfortunately, but that one I mentioned from 82, there were a few comments on there of people saying, yeah, I saw these guys at St. Andrews back in whatever.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of enthusiasm for those shows among just commenters on that post on YouTube. I thought that was really interesting.
Those were great nights. So we would play Saturday all the time. Like,
okay.
all the time. We didn't overplay. But when we played St. Andrews, we'd get 900, 1,000 people.
Really?
And this is, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh. Good
so
for you, man. That's
we
great.
Turned, we put out a couple EPs locally. One was a four-track record called Swimming. and yep. that did very well. Like there was local radio that jumped behind it, and that kicked us into a little different realm in terms of, and then we wound up playing, you know, opening for the B-52s in front of 18,000 people right now. So, you know, signs were pointing up.
Yes. Yes. Then, now, do you just have stars in your eyes? I mean, did you grow up wanting to be a professional musician / maybe even a rock star, and your dreams are starting to come true, and so you're on the fast track?
I was the guy voted most musical in my high school. Somewhere in the world, I doubt it still exists, but my uncle would have a little reel-to-reel tape of me singing Hound Dog in 1962. I was three. You know, I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan when I was just like, I was about ready to turn 5 years old.
Yeah.
And like most people who saw it, I went nuts.
There you go.
I don't know. That's been my direction in life.
Okay.
I've been in a band of one form or another since I was 14.
Oh, goodness. Okay. Yep. That's your thing. For a guy with the dreams that you had, the hopes and the talent and the voice, and the chops, is it ever disappointing that you haven't been able to make a living as a professional musician? Or are you kind of okay with all that?
I don't know if I'm okay with it, but, you know, there are people more talented than I who've had worse breaks. And the world of music is littered with that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I just put my head down. I mean, that's why I am extremely active right now, musically. So, I don't know, this is actually a really good time for me.
Good.
Am I seeing any real money out of it? No. If I was doing it for money, I would have bailed on it a long time ago. I do it for my mental health.
So it's satisfying those creative urges that lay dormant otherwise, right? So
absolutely.
It gives you that. I know exactly what you mean. That's why I started this podcast.
I had a period after Figures on a Beach broke up and before I started putting together what became Fire King, where I wasn't doing much at all musically.
Yeah.
And I was running a business and doing well at it, but I was really unhappy.
I bet.
And you start realizing what's important to you.
Yeah, so, I agree.
And then you hit little milestones like turning 50.
Oh.
You think, well, what am I going to do? What am I going to leave behind? So.
I know what you mean. Not to make this about myself, but I somebody was asking me recently about starting the podcast and how to, you know, how's it going and how do you feel? And I realized, I'm younger than you, I'm 42, but there does come that point, and maybe you can sympathize with this, where you're, you know, it's just like the talking heads say, you are going to the same job every day, and you come home, and you got your wife and your kids, and you go to bed, and then you get up and you do it again. And that, when you were younger, you thought you'd do more and you thought you'd accomplish more, and now it's too late. I can't take big risks with my life because it affects the five people in my family, you know? I'm kind of where I am, and finally now at this stage of my life realize the importance of having a hobby that you're passionate about, because it occupies the space in your brain that would normally be telling you how sad you are that you didn't take better advantage of whatever in your life.
Youth, and the truest cliche in the world.
Exactly. Yes.
The youth is wasted on the young. It
cannot
be.
It is. It is so true.
You know, the song, Ooh La La, I Wish I Knew What I Knew Now When I Was Younger.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
I know. I know.
Nobody, until you get to a certain point, you can't understand how true it is.
No. But if you have something, it arouses your intellect and your creativity. And it can take your mind off the other stuff, whether you're making money on it or not. It's just nice to be able to turn that part of your brain off. Don't you? I mean,
I guess we're just
commiserating about this stage of our lives. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go back to you.
That's quite all right.
Okay. So you moved to Boston. Did you know people there? Why didn't you just go to New York City? I assume that's where most people are getting kind of discovered.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the thing. We were playing New York pretty regularly and doing really well. And we played Danceteria a bunch, and we were going over there. And we attracted the eye of Ivan, who was the DJ there, a pretty prominent one, and who was behind, you remember the Dominatrix Weeks Tonight? Dominate. really popular 12-inch in like 84.
I'm sure I'd know it as soon as I heard it.
You would. Okay. And he produced Book of Love and a few other bands.
Oh, sure.
So, anyways, we were going to New York.
Oh, yeah, that guy. I know exactly who you mean now.
So
sure.
The next record we made was an EP, or just a single, actually, but a 12-inch that did very well, called Breathless. Don Was, mm-hmm. from Was That Was, who is, you know, he's now the head of Blue Note.
Yeah, I read about that. That's an odd pairing. I mean, he's out there doing Bonnie, not back then, because now he's like, you know, a Bonnie Raitt guy. I don't see him as a synth-pop guy.
He's a Detroit guy.
Oh, I didn't think about that. Okay.
And Don Was came up through the whole punk scene in Detroit. He was in a band called The Traitors. They played bookies all the time.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah.
There's more commonality there than you might think. And, you know,
yeah, that's probably true.
Those were cool sessions, and, you know, John Sinclair came by the session. Thought, this is really awesome, right? You know?
Interesting.
So that record did really well for us. We were getting played in Los Angeles, and I'd have people, even when we were on tour 5 years later, this is just on an indie label, we would put that song in the set, and people would remember it. You know, out west where we'd never been before. That was probably the height of whatever commercially was going on in Detroit. And then, you know, without really getting too libelous or whatever, we started developing management problems.
Yeah.
You know, there definitely became a point in time where there was some frustration that things weren't moving faster, because the way things were structured then, you know, the idea was you would get some sort of major label contract and continue to make records. And it wasn't happening. So I think there was frustration on both sides of the fence. How's that? A little bit that very diplomatically. We recorded another record for Metro America called Paradise at the end of 84, which I think was good, and put it out in early 85, and then the label ran into money problems and folded. So that was that. Finding a copy of those is interesting. I've been trying for years to sort of get our master tapes back.
You don't have your own copy of that stuff?
No. I mean, I have copies. They're not masters. They're vinyl rips. So if we wanted to put it out, and there are people who I think, especially the Detroit era fans, that those are the most representative songs. And I have some regrets that some early material that was really solid never really made it to a proper recorded form. You know, stuff songs. There was a song we did called Pure that was sort of a showstopper. And it was pretty out there, too. It started off with Rick Ralphie's backup vocal consists in the entire song of the phrase, walk, talk, Peter Falk. Don't ask me why, but it worked.
Nice. That's great.
It's a bit of a theater piece. But, you know, you were asking earlier about how things wound up poppy, but see, the whole thing is we were experimental, but we were also very interested in songs.
Yeah.
And certainly my contribution to any group I'm in, whether I'm the principal songwriter or whether it's like Figures, where it was very collaborative. People would come in with a riff and we would jam. I tended to write the vast majority of the lyrics and certainly the vocal melodies. But, you know, that was a collaborative band.
In many
ways.
How do you look back on those albums? I'm really curious. I've read good and bad things about them. I have my own thoughts. I'm curious how you feel about the two Figures albums.
The two ones on Sire?
Yeah, those two.
Okay, that's after we moved. So.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, we added a fifth member and named Perry Tell. And this was also part of, you know, I'd say external pressure on the band in order to do it. The theory was that in order for us to become commercially viable, me, Anthony Kaczynski, had to be a front person. And they wanted to get me out behind the keyboards, which was really not taken with this idea.
You were the voice, though, right? Or were you not the voice early on?
You were, but
you were content to stand behind your keyboards and not be necessarily in the front of the stage.
I was in the front of the stage, but I was behind keyboards. And
there
was some theory that wasn't, you know, enough or something like that.
They wanted you standing at the mic stand.
The burgeoning age of MTV, I mean, I'm not joking, there were dance lessons arranged for me. If you've ever really spent any amount of time around me, you know that that's a fool's errand.
I can imagine. And,
you know, and it just seemed, I don't know. This is the early days of MTV, and everybody had to have an angle. And
sure.
So we brought in Perry Tell, and he was a multi-instrumentalist, and so he could do my parts. And then later on, we had sequence. The technology caught up with us, and basically I would just play my parts in, and we would run them through a sequencer live. Everything else was live, but me. My music parts were running through. That sort of freeze-dries your show because you have to stay to those tempos and Michael has to play to a click track, you know. I mean, we were still good, but it takes a lot of spontaneity out to do things that way.
And I can imagine.
The early Figures was much more spontaneous. I'll put it that way. So things sort of reached a bad patch for us in 85 and we were still drawing well. We were just sort of at wit's end, and relationship between us and our management wasn't good. And since they ran the biggest nightclub in town, that was problematic. And the label, as I said, was going belly up, and it was like, what are we doing here? And Perry Tell actually got a transfer from his job to Boston. It's not much, you know, it's just a job working retail, and it was a temporary thing. But they said, if you want to move, you could do it. And he brought me in. And I was having sort of a personal crisis in my own life at the time. The woman I was living with at the time had passed away from cancer at a very young age of 24.
Whoa.
So this is not a good time for me personally. And so I was given the opportunity of a fresh start, and I thought, well, now would be the time to do it.
Yeah.
So I left Detroit, and, you know, my heart's still there. I really miss Detroit, and we go all the time. We just came back from there. It wasn't really that I wanted to leave. It's that I think for my own my own sanity at the time I had to. And I
so you didn't go to Boston thinking this is where we're going to get discovered. That was just a move of convenience at the time.
It
happened
to be I thought we can get to New York quicker. That's for sure.
Yeah, true. Okay. Yep.
That was a thing. I'd never been to Boston before.
Right.
I got off a plane and walked into an apartment I'd never been in and watched the cockroaches scatter. No joke. Welcome home.
I believe
a little hovel on Revere Street on the back side of Beacon Hill. So you could tell people that you lived in Beacon Hill, but the place, you know, looked over a little airless alleyway with no light, and, you know, really pretty grim.
Oh, man. Oh, man.
And the thing that, you know, it's funny, I didn't do my homework. You know, Boston's not exactly, in the mid-'80s, a friendly city to bands with synthesizers.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah,
tons of great bands. Well, Detroit's blue-collar, too, but for whatever reason, the Detroits and the Clevelands of the world have always loved, you know, glammy things and Bowie and Roxy and all that stuff. And I'm not saying Boston didn't. We found an audience in Boston, but it was there was a lot of resistance to us at first because it was like, who are these guys? And, you know, nobody really cared about all the amount of legwork we'd already put in, et cetera. So we were sort of muddling around in Boston, and we did a demo at Downtown Recorders and sent it to Ivan Ivan, who had a connection with Seymour Stein at Sire. And they heard the song No Stars, and they loved it. So we're playing a gig at the Rat in Boston, and I get a phone call during soundcheck. This is sort of odd. Anyways, who calls you at soundcheck? And it was Seymour Stein, and he said, "Welcome to Sire Records."
No way.
Yes way.
Yes.
And then they said, "Can you come to New York tomorrow?" And they had us cut No Stars.
Oh. Now, does it sound just like it does on the album?
No, the only piece that we used from it is there's a piano solo in it that I played. That's flown in from the New York part of it.
Really?
We recut everything else.
That song is a hit. Now, I got to be honest with you. That has showed up on another one of those. I think it was Just Say Yo. Oh, was it on Just Say Yes?
Yeah.
Those compilations are awesome, by the way.
Yeah.
If anyone out there listening, they're so good. There's seven of them. I don't think I ever heard that song on the radio. Granted, we've established I grew up in Utah. Things maybe might be a little behind or something.
Oh, yeah.
But,
you know, it's funny. It was the number one song in Cheyenne, Wyoming for a couple of weeks. That's not a lie. That's the truth.
That's great. Good.
And there was a moment when they did a video for it. And
I know. That's like the only video I can find.
Is that the only
professional video that was made for Fingers?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. We were never a priority at Sire. That's the truth. We were never...
But isn't creating videos for just about every one of your artists, isn't that a priority?
Theoretically.
But they just weren't doing it. And you're this, I mean, so I don't know you at all. All I know is pictures. You look really intimidating these days because you have the really long hair and everything.
Right.
But back in the day, you were this really, you know, pretty blonde guy in the suit and looking super handsome and stuff like that. Well, I wonder... They didn't take more advantage of that, huh? We got this, like, eye-catchy frontman.
Yeah, they missed,
and poppy
they missed
songs.
Us when we were pretty.
I know. They could have taken total advantage. Now you're this older guy with the super long hair. That's kind of intimidating.
I'm not that intimidating.
Okay, good. I can tell that now. I'm just going by pictures. But anyway, yeah, so that I just thought, why is there only one video from this band? And it's not even for Accidentally 4th Street, and it's the cover.
That's actually on our first album, though, for Sire. So
that's true.
The song the guy assigned. And that was in line to be like MTV's Video of the Week and all this happy stuff. And once again, we were dogged by management problems our whole career. So we were basically assigned a manager by Sire. And he was a famous manager named Bill LaCoin.
You were with Bill LaCoin?
For about 3 months. So he was, you know, of course, Kiss.
Of course.
And Billy Idol after that. And
Stars. Bill
LaCoin. If you were still here, I don't really bear him any ill will. He left us a few years ago. Had a very nasty drug problem.
Yes.
And on the day
I'm a huge
Kiss
fan, so I know a lot about it.
Well, yeah, he told me that he actually started a party at his house in 1978, and it ran until 1981.
Yeah.
In other words, there was always somebody there. He was very reduced at the time.
Yeah.
He was full of good ideas and still had connections, but, you know, the day that we were supposed to go use his pretty considerable expertise to help with the video shoot in New York, I couldn't find him.
Oh, no.
So... And that was at the Gramercy Park Hotel. So I actually am the man who fired Bill LaCoin on the phone. Yeah.
Wow.
And then they hooked us up with these people from the album network. Let me put it this way. If you read a book called Hitmen by Frederick Dannon.
Yeah, I've heard of it. I haven't read it.
Yeah, these are people who were in the promotions end of the business.
Sure.
And they had handled such, I'm really putting quotes around this, compatible acts to us as Night Ranger and Damn Yankees, which was Tommy Shaw and Ted Nugent. And I knew this is a bad fit, but they could get us on the radio to an extent.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Who knows what strings they were pulling, whatever.
Sure.
So that,
Night Ranger was big back then.
You know, whatever. Yeah. Totally didn't understand what the band was about.
No, of course. Not the right fit for you. I'm just talking in general. If we're looking for people who know how to get things on radio, they might be able to.
I remember we were demoing stuff for the second album. We had this song called Pretty Paper that honestly prefigures Nine Inch Nails by like 2 years. Like what became industrial, and we presented it to them, and they were like, "What is this?" Like,
really? Oh, they didn't even know what to do with it.
They didn't know what to do with it, and I think this plagued us our entire career. And to whatever extent, when I look back at things myself, the rest of the band, they're all individuals. I'm sure they would feel the same way. We all should have been a little more assertive.
Yeah, probably.
We don't know any better
back then.
Kind of, sort of, and you think, well, if I do this thing, maybe it'll help do this thing. And actually what winds up happening is you end up doing a version of You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet by BTO that is intended for a cover album by a bunch of various Sire artists that never comes out. And yep. then the label hears it and goes, no, that should be your first single from your record.
Yeah.
They go in and they remix the record and take out, if you listen to the album version versus the single version,
uh-huh.
the album version I think has some humor because we were just trying to have fun.
Okay.
And turn it into like a sort of a high energy disco song. And the
uh-huh.
way it's mixed and everything is a certain way. The mix that wound up getting used for the radio, they programmed different keyboard parts. Not good ones either, and made it sound very adult contemporary. And my voice got, I heard it and I cried. It sounds like a power ballad. Whether people liked it or not, that's up to them.
Right.
It wasn't a representation of the band. And we'd go play gigs, and people were coming to hear that, and they would
yeah.
get what we really were. And
yeah.
we got a lot of head scratching. And conversely, people who'd been with us for a while thought we had sold
yeah.
out.
What are you doing? Yeah. I was reading you were featured in a book called Flashback to Happiness.
Yeah.
Where you contributed a story about the recording of that song and just how miserably it all turned out. I don't remember, even though I think that reached number 67?
69.
69. Ooh, even better. 69 in 1989. I don't think I ever heard the adult contemporary reverb-y one. I only know the version that's on the album.
Yeah, there's if you look it up, you can find it. There's a single.
I'll find it on YouTube, I'm sure.
To me, it sounds pretty different.
Okay.
And it's in subtle ways. It's just the amount
yeah.
of reverb that's put on things. You know, it's just so radio-friendly and so safe.
Nah, that's too bad. And yet, that's your biggest chart success.
Yeah.
They couldn't push No Stars, which is obviously like a way superior pop song, or Gloria. They couldn't act
yeah,
on the 4th Street. They couldn't do something with either of those.
Everybody who ever heard No Stars said this is a mass single. So
yeah.
you go figure, you know. And, you know, I would go, Sire was a subset of Warner Brothers, and you'd go
yeah.
to the label and you'd go have a meeting at Burbank, and really they were interested in promoting George Harrison. And that's fine.
Oh, was this Cloud Nine period?
Yeah. There wasn't much energy around us.
This is a common story, Anthony, just about everybody I've had on here. It's
oh, yeah.
internal label politics that have nothing to do with the band or the artist. It's all something else that's going on, and they are the victims of it, and it impacts their lives forever, whereas a record label, and well, I mean, to a lesser degree now, they just continue on because they're a business
yeah, but
and
they
it's
got
not about
theirs
people.
Now. They're all gone,
yes.
too.
Yeah, they're all gone,
you
too.
Know. Anyway, so we soldiered, you know, we did this tour that I'm talking to you about for
yeah.
through Salt Lake City, et cetera. We did something like 40 dates in 1989. And here's another, you know, like, should we have gone this road? We were offered a tour opening up for the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
What? Really?
Yeah, the bill would have been the Red Hot Chili Peppers, the Butthole Surfers, and us. I turned it down. And so the rest of the band. And I think, honestly, kind of wisely, I just don't
yeah.
see us functioning on the same bill as the Butthole Surfers.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see it
I
either.
Think
they
it
were
would have been a lot
big.
Of hostility.
Yeah, you might be. Yeah, you know, that's true. I never thought of that before. But is it, you know, there's exposure, and then there's the right kind of exposure. Maybe you're playing to bigger audiences, but maybe they don't. Maybe they hate you more than a smaller audience
yeah,
would.
Yeah, because every single time we played in front of somebody, it went really well. We played
uh-huh.
with Nina Hagen, Ultravox, ABC, Adam Ant. I mean, they were throwing panties
oh,
on
man.
The stage.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
great. we played with the later day Tubes. You know, She's a
really?
Beast, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And we got booed. We got booed. So it told me something. Like the more mainstream an audience.
Yeah.
We weren't flying with them. And I just thought that was a bad fit for us. So we did this club tour instead.
Yeah.
To try and stick that second record over. I never really knew how much we sold through Warner's. We were never given much information. I have no clue.
Right.
They didn't do a great job of getting the records into the stores all the time. And, you know.
Yeah.
They asked us to demo a third record. And I remember just talking to a woman I actually liked very much at Sire, named Shirley Divers, who also is no longer with us. But I liked her. She was one of the good guys.
Yeah.
And she said, you should be a little further along. We're not doing very well by you. And I said, should we become a free agent? You know? And said, we could do that. We could have put out a third record on Sire, but it was like we had this terrible management that we didn't like.
Sure. Yeah.
And a bad deal, and we thought we could go it alone. So we scared up a bunch of material that's pretty good and got nowhere with getting another deal with anybody.
Yeah.
The ability to put it out.
Oh, that's too bad.
And we weren't wealthy, and the way of recording things was such, it's not like now where you can do things kind of on the cheap, recording-wise, and get something that sounds good. So we weren't exactly hauling in big amounts of money. But anyways, after knocking our heads against the wall, and we'd been together then, was like 12 years. For, the energy for the project started dissipating.
Sure,
put it
of course.
Way.
So what do you do then? So you're not, I mean, you're a middling rock star when you are one at the height, and now it's time to do something else. What is that like? I mean, when you wake up in the morning, the day after you're no longer a rock star, do you think, what do I do with myself? Do I have to go get a regular
job?
Well,
there's sort
of
that.
Still thinking about other music things.
Yeah, I started a business with my now ex-wife, and we're still business partners. I tend to try and remain friendly with people. We run a court reporting agency.
Oh, really?
We've had the business for 23 years, and I was doing editing even during the major label figures days because it was something I could do at home on a odd schedule and still, you know, make money, because there was no point in time that we really could live on it. Like, we went to London to record the first record, which was exciting. We recorded a Trident, pretty famous studio.
Yeah,
Queen, David Bowie, you know.
Good for you.
You know, that was great. So we lived in London for a couple months in 1987, but when we came back, we still had to work.
Yeah.
And just like, you know, we could go out on tour, there was enough money there to pay the bills for a couple months, but when we came back home, you had to go back to work. I mean, nobody was under any delusions that this was, you know, the fact that you sign a deal that says you're getting a $150,000, $200,000 budget for an album, that sounds like, hey, jackpot.
Right. No, that's you owe that money to them somehow.
And you see very, very little
after
recording costs, after them charging you to FedEx you something that doesn't need to be FedEx, you know.
So No, you sound very practical. You know, it's interesting. You probably saw those comments made by Steve Miller after his Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, and he's saying very similar things. It's obviously I don't know if corrupt is the right word. If you watch Vinyl, which I know we got to talk about Vinyl because you and I are both hate watching that show. It's the worst show ever, and yet I'm going to see through this season because I have to, but it is the biggest wasted opportunity in TV history.
I'm
so angry at this show.
It's amazing. And there's so many things wrong with it, but the biggest thing wrong with it is the nasty bits.
Yes!
How is that non-band supposed to change the face of popular music?
I have no idea.
Plus, whenever they play something that's allegedly by them, it sounds sort of like 1990s corporate punk.
Yes, it does. I know.
I was alive in the 70s. They were much sloppier and much cooler.
Yes. Yes. I just keep watching this show thinking, I thought all of this was supposed to be fun. Nobody here is having any fun. Nobody.
Isn't it amazing? They're so grim.
It is. A regular person would think this is like the heyday. Who wouldn't want to work in the music industry in the 70s, and yet everyone is miserable.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was, you know what, even though I'm telling you, you know, some things that don't sound like A Day at the Beach. We had a blast.
Of course you
even,
did, yeah.
Even through the worst of it. I don't remember feeling grim. Of course there were bad moments, but most of the experience that I walked away with was this was a blast. It was great. It was great fun. And when I go back to Detroit in particular, people have fond memories about the whole thing. And, you know, there's often calls to reunite for a gig or whatever, but I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know? You can't do that? You can't go back to Detroit and just play a show every now and then?
I play there all the time with Fire King.
Well, yeah, but I mean, people who want to see, you know, an original, have a night out with Figures on a Beach for once
and
in
I always,
30 years or whatever.
The thing is, we're sort of far flung, and
Figures
was very orchestrated and had very particular sounds, and very by the end, our gigs were a bit of a production.
Okay.
So, in order to get that all back, and I wouldn't want to put something out that was substandard.
Yeah.
What would be the point
yeah.
of that? That's
right.
That's just nobody's having fun. It would require a lot of work. For me, I'm actually much more invested in my present reality.
Okay.
Than that, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's not that easy to go back. I was curious about that. Okay, so then when Figures ends, and you spend the 90s running this business, is that still to this day your primary source of income is running
the court reporter business?
Okay. Do you have some other job, or is that your job, running that
That's
business?
My job. That's my job.
Okay.
Okay,
so I think you posted a picture on Facebook recently of opening day, and it was you in your living room, and you have a nice living room. And it was chock full of records and books, which is like heaven for me. So
I thought, good, Anthony's doing okay.
Good. Okay. Good. Yeah, I was impressed to see that. I was happy to see that you're okay. I didn't know you'd ever know, you know, with some of these people.
It's a tenuous existence, and a self-employed person in America in 2016 who's 57 years old is staring at some pretty harsh reality later on that, I am by no means wealthy.
You're making it, and that's great.
From week to week, I'm okay,
I know, most people are like that, so that's okay.
Yeah.
No, we got to talk about Fire King. Rare that when I talk to people for this thing, I am more turned on by their new music than whatever it was that turned me on to them in the first place. That Double Trouble album is one of the most amazing things I've ever heard, and I'm not just blowing smoke at you. In fact, I belong to this power pop Facebook group, and I posted after I'd heard it, when you alerted me to it recently, I posted on there, does anyone know these guys? Because this is some of the best stuff I've ever heard. And a couple of people responded saying, let's see, one guy said, playing a show with Fire King this Saturday in Detroit. That was last week. There was another guy who said some really good stuff. Another guy who played with them in New York City last fall. Great band, very nice guys. It got some good response, and I was glad that there were people out there. Man, if I could give a copy of Double Trouble to everyone in the world would be a better place. That thing is
amazing. That's really kind. It's true. I think it's the best thing I've ever done, easily.
It's incredible. So when did you shift
from wanting to be early Simple Minds to being Cheap Trick. And now you're playing guitar, right?
Yeah. You know, I go back, you know, we all wear our influences our sleeve. I go back to Cheap Trick from the very first album. Like, I was an enormous fan way before Budokan, et cetera. So, in fact, my first apartment, I graduated from high school in 77, and in September I got an apartment. My very first act as a quote-unquote adult was to set up my stereo in my new apartment. I had, like, you know, two pieces of furniture, but I had records, and I set up the stereo, and I put on In Color, which was brand new by Cheap Trick, and played Hello There as loud as I could. I used to sing along with those records, and that was somebody I thought Robin Zander was an amazing vocalist. So
yes.
It couldn't help but get in there. I don't think we're a copy by any means, but you can.
No.
Yeah.
I just mean it's of the same ilk. It's equally as good, honestly. I've heard both the albums. I like the first one a lot too. Any album, and that I saw it on AllMusic.com. There are 5 people credited with hand claps. To be the greatest thing ever, right? To have 5 people credited with hand claps, but then Double Trouble is mind blowing. It's perfection, and the fact that you did it for 22 tracks is miraculous.
That's awesome to hear. See, there's a 14-year gap between those records.
I know. What happened? You guys are just doing this however you can do it, since it's not. No one has aspirations of, like we've talked about, having this be your gig that makes you rich or a rock star. So it's just, we do it when we do it.
Yeah, well, that's sort of how it happened. So after Figures broke up and I had sort of my years in the wilderness, and I was burnt out on playing keyboards. I thought I wanted to play guitar, and I've always been able to play bass a little bit, and I got fairly good at it, but the things are very different. So I kind of taught myself how to play guitar.
Yeah,
and
so
then
good.
Some songs started happening. So I hadn't talked to Michael in a long time, and I just brought him back in, and we would start writing stuff together. Like, he's always been, we've played together for so long, he knows where I'm going to go.
Yeah.
Very, very intuitively. And so we would do occasional gigs, but we had a hard time getting a permanent bass player. And also, to the level that we were playing, which was not that frequently, it sort of resembled Saturday Night Bowling.
You know, let's go out with the friends and knock back some rock and roll.
Sure.
And so we did that first record just because I wanted to get, I also had writer's block for a long time where I couldn't write lyrics.
Interesting.
And I got over it, and I thought I want to at least make a record again.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Live a Little, Love a Little is a very tentative step in a lot of ways. I like some of the songs on it, but, you know, and that was, for the most part, just the two of us playing on there. So,
except for the five people hand clapping.
Yeah, that's a different tune.
right. That's so great. Genius move. Anyway, okay, sorry.
And so, you know, the 2000s progressed, and I don't know, we picked up, I was playing basketball a lot at the time, and I met this fellow named Drew Morrison, and we would talk about music, and I realized we had a lot in common. He's more your age. It turns out he played bass a little. He'd not been in a band, but I thought his attitude is so good and we're so simpatico, why not try it out? And he's gotten to the point where he's really good. He really brings a lot
right
to the
on.
Table now. Live
good.
Too. So that's great. And so he
good.
Came in around 2007 or so. And so we started to have a little bit of stability. But again, you know, you're in your 50s, late 40s, you're running your life. And it's hard to devote the amount of time to it that you want to devote. But somewhere around the time I hit 50, 51, I had my own personal issues and big changes in my life. And I started thinking, what's important?
Yeah.
Like we talked about earlier. And I thought, you need to commit yourself to music because that's the thing I'm really good at. And it's the thing that I can do that brings me some joy. And so I thought, we had a lot of songs. And I thought, why not make a double record? And it'll take some time to do it, but so what? And honestly, it came out the way I wanted it to, which is like, that's the first time in my life I can honestly say that.
Yeah.
Any of the Figures records all seemed compromised in some way, or I didn't like the production, or there's something dated about it, or something that I listen to and wince a little bit. Even though there's some really good stuff, I'm not.
No, I know there's strong songs in there, but I mean, I love '80s music because I grew up in the '80s, so my ear is tuned to even the, you know, the most synthetic or synthesized production. But yeah, I know what you mean. I mean,
well, there's a moment in time in the late '80s where everybody started using the same keyboards too. So those sounds become very generic in a way. You know, like everybody's using a DX7, everybody's using a Roland D50, and you can hear it, and it automatically dates the stuff, regardless of how good the song is. So those are production decisions. So you know, I tried to do something with Double Trouble, and we're working with a guy named Ducky Carlisle, who's a tremendous engineer. He's great. He's a great engineer and great producer. Super musical. Has a Grammy. Has two. For mixing Buddy Guy Records. Yep.
No way. Nice. Next and
way.
He's working with you. Okay.
Yes. Yep.
And you guys just play shows whenever you can cobble something together? And
well, no.
I don't imagine.
That's the whole thing. This is taken on a different life. So back in 2010, I want to say the year when everything sort of changed for me, I was also approached to do a solo acoustic show, which I'd never done before, as part of this songwriters thing by a woman named Natalie Flanagan at this little place in Boston called The Tavern at the End of the World. And I went there and did my thing, very nervous, and met a bunch of local people, really good musicians, and decided that I really liked that scene, so I started hanging out there. So I wound up becoming the guitar player in Natalie's band for 5 years. That's ended, but that was a great, great experience, too,
because
it turned me into a better guitar player, having to play somebody else's music and be at the service of those songs. There's a bartender there named Tim Carey who's kind of an amazing songwriter, and he had a project called Trusty Sidekick, and I heard them in Provincetown. We were doing a gig with Natalie, and something clicked for me, and I was like, I have to work with these people. So they wound up asking me to produce them, which I'd never done before, so we did a record and turned Trusty Sidekick into a band.
Sinkholes in the Dead Sea. There's a million holes in the stories that you told me. Looking for the horizon ever since I laid eyes on.
each other, so we can lay together. The bodies and lies in the sea, and we'll repeat and repeat and repeat our lies to each other.
I started playing with them. So there's Fire Drink, Nellie Flanagan, Trusty Sidekick. And all of a sudden, I'd find myself gigging two times a week and really enjoying it. Then I got drafted into a few more bands. So then in 2013, I actually went on the road with Chris Ewan from Figures as Future Bible Heroes.
Oh, sure.
Which is a project that he's done with Stephen Merritt. And Stephen could not make that tour. Stephen Merritt of the Magnetic Field. So Stephen could not make that tour because he was suffering from a hearing issue at the time. So I kind of filled in for him. I'm like Glenn. I was like Glenn Campbell filling in for Brian Wilson.
Yeah, right.
On the tour, and that was really fun. You know, we did 12, 13 dates, but they were good rooms: Bowery Ballroom in New York and the Echoplex in Los Angeles. And
nice.
You know, yeah, it was real stuff again. I've been drafted in to be the singer in a version of the Atlantics, who are a very popular band here in Boston, so we occasionally get together to do shows. I play guitar in a band called Black Souls with Cam and Kim Acklin. Cam Acklin was in a band called Prime Movers and the Voodoo Dolls here. It's like all 60s R&B and garage covers of the obscure variety. That's a lot of fun. I sub in a lot for people. I've played, you know, bass on an emergency basis for John Pajita International Airport, who's great. John Pajita is a talent that should see the light of day. So I added this up, and, you know, I'm in like 10 bands.
That's incredible. So, I mean, you're in your 50s, and you're just now busy. You're busier than ever. And, I mean, let's be honest, it's the fact that you maintained this business all along that gives you some of the financial freedom to be able to do all these projects, right?
Right. I can take off to Detroit. We play at least once or twice a month, and that's about as much as you can play.
Sure.
In a market. But we're starting to get played on the local radio shows here, so there's some energy around this.
Good. Well, if you ever make it out to Denver, I'll keep an eye out because I'll be there.
You should let me know what clubs to play.
I could name a few. There's some great places here. Oh, man.
I played Denver once, but it was memorable. Figures on a Beach played at Regis College in 1985. Outdoors. We did three sets.
Whoa. Really?
Yeah. We did three
sets. That is a trip. So, you didn't even play here when Figures was at their peak promoting an album. That's so weird. So I gotta ask a couple of kind of questions that I ask everybody. First of all, did you ever meet any heroes? I mean, you opened for bands that would be considered some of my heroes, like Psychedelic Furs and Echo and the Bunnymen and stuff like that.
And the band I enjoyed playing with the most was X. We did five dates with them.
Wait, Figures opened for X?
Several times.
That doesn't even make sense. That's as weird as the Chili Peppers.
But I kind of did at the time. And that was early. That was 82.
Oh, okay.
That was Under the Big Black Sun. Put out a record yet at that point.
Whoa.
The second run we did, we had an EP out. I take that back because we did shows in Cincinnati and Cleveland with them, but we played with them in Detroit and Grand Rapids, and we didn't even have a record out.
Oh, crazy. So did you ever meet any heroes back then? I mean, I don't know if you were ever at, like, award shows or playing festivals or, you know, finding in the same, in the Sire office while somebody else is Madonna walking around or something. I mean, was there ever a moment when
Letty,
you...
I met Letty Kay. That was cool.
Oh, that is cool. Oh, nice. Okay, great. Yeah.
I, you know, it's funny what the people that you think, you know, and I went to go oversee the mastering of the first Sire record, and this guy walks out of the other office at Sterling Sound in New York and goes, "Hi, I'm Marshall Crenshaw." That was
cool. I love Marshall Crenshaw.
Another
Michigander.
Another
Michigander.
Yes. So.
Oh, I love him so much. Right on. So see, that's the stuff I think is cool, too, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I want to talk
so,
to people like you.
And the other thing that I was always really struck by is that we opened for ABC on their first tour, which was, you know, Lexicon of Love and everything.
That's one of my favorite albums by one of my favorite bands ever.
And Martin Fry stood in the wings and watched our whole set.
Really?
Which I thought was really sweet.
Nice.
People don't always do that. And,
wow.
And I mentioned this in Dukes of Rock, too, that Adam Ant and their road crew were really kind to us. And they had this big, big, enormous spread of Indian food. And they basically said, "Go nuts." They shared their food with us. Which, you know, it doesn't sound like much, but in 1983, we were really poor.
Yeah.
You could do this show at Masonic Auditorium in front of 5,000 people and look big, but, you know, the reality was nobody had a dime.
So that's great.
It was
Did you get
sweet.
To meet Adam Ant?
I met Marco.
Okay, Marco. I just finished reading Adam Ant's autobiography just a couple of weeks ago. He sounded like he was kind of a handful, but I respect him a lot too. His music's
great.
It
was a great show. That was a good. I have memories of that being a great show on all fronts for us and them. So
good,
really, really fun.
I've been fascinated with you for 25 years now. And most of it was because of one particular song that I couldn't get out of my head for most of my life. But it's turned me, accidentally. By the way, why is it called that?
It was a broadside, and it was written during the height of the Iran-Contra hearings.
Hmm.
So the person on the cover of the magazine is Oliver North. And
I wondered about that.
You know, I was sort of nodding to Dylan.
I thought so. Okay, that's what I figured. Yeah, great song. But then that just opened the floodgates to wanting to get to know your other stuff, and there's a lot of it that means a lot to me.
I'm glad you enjoyed Double Trouble so much. That's very heartening.
I love it.
We have another one on the way. There's four songs recorded, and I don't know if you looked at my page, but there's a tribute to the band Sloan. We have a cut on there that I'm very proud of, too. We did the version of The Other Man.
Not the one for you, but that's no fault of mine. He knows that I'm a friend of yours, but doesn't know I've crossed the line. I know you got a man in the picture, but it hasn't stopped me yet. We've all been in one situation or another we regret.
Their Pretty Together record that I'm really
happy
with.
I love that album.
And actually, the comp is really good. There's the digital version of it. There's 31 different bands and 31 songs. As tribute things go, I have to say the bar is set really high.
Good. They deserve it.
I know of a few of the people who worked on it, but I'm really pleased with everything I heard on it. So
okay, good.
Check
you know what?
Out.
I was going to ask you, I want to buy the Double Trouble album. I prefer, like, a physical CD. How would I buy it where you would get the most back? If
you
I buy it off iTunes or SoundCamp, what was it? What's the way?
There's two ways. Bandcamp is great. Fire King has a page on Bandcamp, and you can buy it. We pressed vinyl on this, too.
I don't collect vinyl because I would put my family in the poorhouse. if I collected vinyl.
Right.
So
right.
I try not
so to. For those of you who do, there's a yes. very nicely mastered and kind of beautiful looking vinyl copy, but you can also buy the CD from
okay.
there. So Bandcamp is very nice because it's like a one-on-one thing. If you order it from there, I'm the person who puts it in the envelope and sends it to you.
Oh, good. Okay,
also,
good.
Also, I think the people at CD Baby are very incredibly fair, too. So
okay.
I if you order through CD Baby, that's good for digital purchases and for CDs. They carry our
okay.
stuff. So
okay.
And they're very honest, and their accounting is really transparent. Unlike
good.
The major labels.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding. That's why I asked, because I wanted to do it whatever way you got the best cut. And
either
if,
or
I was
is
afraid
fine with
if
me.
I bought it from iTunes, I don't know how much they take out of it before you make your
we
money.
Don't, you, so. Don't, you don't see anything from them until you hit a certain level, and chances are I
oh.
never will.
Oh.
So
oh,
the Bandcamp CD Baby options are way, way more
okay.
artist-friendly.
Okay. Okay, good. I'll do one of those. Great.
I would think that would be true of anybody, you know.
Okay.
If awesome. They're running their stuff that way.
Excellent. Okay. Well, thanks again, Anthony. This was so much fun. I really,
thanks,
really,
John.
Really appreciate it. You're
awesome.
A good man.
There you have it, Anthony Kaczynski. A lot to unpack here. If you came to this as a Figures fan, hopefully you were turned on by Fire King. And if you came as a Fire King fan, hopefully you were turned on by Figures. Both bands are great, and there's a lot of music to learn from either one. Now, I sort of hate to do this a little bit. I always take great pride in picking the song that plays over the outro. I put a lot of thought into that. And a part of me hates the fact that I'm picking a cover, because there's so much original material that they put out that's good. Fire King, that is. I should probably pick one of those. But their cover of Elvis Costello's Tokyo Storm Warning is so amazing and such an earworm. The haze that they added, it's so much better than Elvis. It's got so much energy. I couldn't help myself. I love this song. I want you to hear it. Hopefully you stick it out to the end. Guys, if this is your first time listening to our podcast and you think the stories of great artists that don't get told very often is interesting, please go into iTunes and subscribe to The Hustle. We put out new episodes every Tuesday. You can write us a review while you're there. I would love the constructive criticism, good or bad. If you want to find an episode that is no longer in iTunes, because not only the last 50 are, go to our website at thehustle.podbean.com, and you can find some of the older episodes on there. Also, if you want to like our Facebook page, you can stay in contact with us that way. Just look us up on Facebook, The Hustle Podcast. You can send me a message on there of who you would like us to track down. If there's an artist that you love that used to be something or used to be out there, or you haven't heard from them for a while, tell me and we'll try and track them down and we'll get them on the show. Or you can send me an email at thehustlepod@gmail.com. Huge thanks, as always, to Jan the Man Makiewicz for producing the podcast. Love you, Jan. You do such a great job. In fact, you know, if anyone out there wants to find me or Jan on Facebook and communicate with either of us personally that way, feel free to find us. Feel free to send us a friend request. If you can spell our last names anyway, that's going to be hard. We'll talk to you all next week with another guest. Thanks, everybody.